Joseph Deitz is founder and chairman of Commonwealth Financial Network, a private independent investment broker-dealer. He's also the chairman of Southworth Development, a leading golf and resort real estate company. He can now add author to his list of credentials. He just published his book, Elevate, An Essential Guide to Life. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here.
So writing a guide to life is an ambitious endeavor. What prompted you to write the book?
I needed it. I had so many questions. And questions we all have: success, happiness, health, energy, relationships. And in my quest, I kept finding so many wonderful answers. And then the notion occurred to me that perhaps I could share this.
So Elevate is broken into two parts: awareness, yes, with five key insights, and action focused on 10 essential skills. So how did you come to this framework?
So after compiling my list of all and everything to do, and it's like, how do you organize it? And I realized that most self-help books are of one of two types. They're either about increasing our awareness, sort of Eckhart Tolle or Deepak Chopra, that kind of thing, or they're how-to, how to improve your golf, how to improve your marriage, how to get better SAT scores. And what I came to appreciate is that they're both incredibly necessary. They're a dynamic. The understanding and the doing, they're together. You can't separate them. Well, you can separate them, but it diminishes your success.
Yeah. So you write asking questions is a superpower. Explain what you mean
by
that.
Oh, totally. So imagine, if you will, you're sitting at home at night and your eccentric uncle that you haven't seen for years, he's sort of like, he's exploring the Amazon, and he comes in to your house and he says, "They're chasing me. Here, take care of this box." And you go, "What is it?" And he says, "It will answer any question you put to it." And you go, "Come on." He goes, "No, really." And he runs out. And you test this box, and it literally answers any question that you put to us. I mean, think of how amazing that is. Well, in reality, we all have this magic box. It's our brain. It will literally answer every question we put to it. But we don't always ask the questions, and we don't necessarily know how to make the most of it.
Mm. I was going to say, I'm thinking, as you're asking a question, sometimes you're getting conflicting answers. How do you know which one is the right answer?
Ah. For myself, it's kind of like my head and my heart. Mm-hmm. And many years ago, I decided I would not, if my head and heart or my head and my intuition were not in sync, I would just hold off. Because that was a signal to me that there was more research I needed to do. And when they are in sync, when there is consensus, that's when I move forward. But a related question is, how can you tell the difference between your deep intuition, almost your divine intuition, and perhaps your fears and desires manifesting themselves? And I've put that specific question to a lot of people that I respect, and they all gave me almost the same answer. And they said, when you know, there comes this point, you just know.
Right. Yeah. You feel sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you suggest we all could improve our self-awareness, how we perceive others, what motivates our thoughts, beliefs, behaviors. Often it takes another person to help us see a more accurate picture of ourselves. So do you think people can achieve self-awareness without the therapy or without feedback from others, or is that part of the process?
How much time do we have for that? So early on in my life, I looked around and I just thought adults were all messed up. Politicians continually lied and people kept believing them, and that hasn't changed. And people had bad habits and they stayed in jobs that weren't satisfying, relationships that weren't nourishing. They didn't necessarily exercise or eat well. And I'm thinking, why don't they practice what they preach? What's wrong with these people over here? Can't they see? And years later, when I become an ally, I realize, oh my God, I'm one of them. I started little by little to see some of my biases, my limitations, my defense mechanisms. And I realized what you asked about in the question. It's so easy to see these things in other people and so hard to see it in ourselves. But we can ask questions. Mm. We can ask questions of ourselves. We can ask questions of others. We can say to people, hey, what do you think I'm missing? Why do you think I'm missing it? Where do you think I'm stuck?
Yeah. You have to be open to hear those things, though. Some people don't want to hear that.
Some people?
Maybe a lot of people. In the United States and elsewhere in the world, women and people of color earn far less than their white male counterparts. And white men are overwhelmingly represented in positions of power and authority. So it could be argued personal growth and happiness for a large segment of the population is less about awareness and change on a personal level and more in the hands of those in the positions of power and authority. What do you think about that?
I think it's everything. I mean, of course, if someone is subjugating us, that holds us back. But we do ourselves a disservice if we put the blame out there, because obviously we can change out there. I'm not suggesting for a second that people not try, but we can absolutely and immediately expand our own awareness. And when I say awareness, I'm not just talking about our minds. I'm talking about our heads and our hearts. If we stop and pay attention to our feelings, to our thoughts, we realize there's a lot of programming and preconditioning there and how we see the world. So this is something we can do immediately, and it has vast and powerful impact.
You founded the Deitch Leadership Institute at the Boston Latin School, a public exam school. So tell us more about the institute.
So I grew up in Boston in Dorchester, and I just did what I was told. I went to school, and one day they told me, hey, why don't you take this test and you can go to Latin school? And I said, okay. So I started there in seventh grade. And it turns out that Boston Latin School is the oldest continuous public school in the United States. It was started in, wait for it, 1635, the year before Harvard. And we like to say that Harvard was started for our graduates. It's a wonderful, wonderful school. And I just had the benefit of an incredible education. And as I think more and more about philanthropy and how I can put my resources to use and I can leverage my resources, what better way than to help a new generation of curious and powerful young minds? So that's one of the initiatives, and that's the Latin School.
So how does it do that? Tell us what the program is, the Leadership Institute. What is it? What do you do?
Well, we try to teach people about leadership, but leadership isn't this 10-course curriculum, and then you take a test, and then you're a leader. Leadership is learning and doing and understanding that the most important person for us to lead in the world is ourselves. And we try our best to help them see beyond what they can currently see, help them to get a glimpse of the power and potential they have and how to give them some tools. Mm. We also offer numerous grants for whatever crazy idea they want to come up with. I mean, we don't fund every crazy right. idea, but we encourage them to come up with ideas. We fund various summer internships so they can get out in the world. And in these particular internships, every participating company has to agree that these high school kids will have access to senior management. And each week they tour a different company and they compare notes.
Hmm. Have you thought about expanding it to other schools? I know Boston Latin probably because you went there, but have you thought about doing something like this in any of the other Boston schools?
I have. I have a long to-do list.
Right. You lost your wife, Robbie, to ovarian cancer in 2006. When she was diagnosed, you both vowed that you'd make cancer the best thing that ever happened to you. So would you talk about the first days and weeks after her diagnosis and what influenced you to this approach to dealing with her illness?
So much of how we conduct ourselves and carry ourselves in life is a function of how we perceive things. And if we perceive something as only a tragedy, woe is me, then that mindset, it's very limiting, it's not healthy. And literally, when we went to the doctor's office, there was a magazine, and the cover story said, cancer was the best thing that ever happened to me. And we looked at each other and we said, this is going to be our mantra. And one specific example, and this is not to make light of cancer. It's a horrible disease, and the patients and the families suffer. But we knew that she was going to be undergoing chemotherapy. And when we went into the doctor's office where they were administering chemo to an entire waiting room, it was one of the saddest things I've ever seen. And I said, we said we weren't going to cry today. Mm-hmm. And I said, I can't let this happen to my wife. So I said, I'll tell you what, honey, we're going to have a chemo party. And the doctor, the oncologist, was a friend, and we said, hey, can we borrow an office, you know, a private office for the chemo? And we said, sure. And we invited her friends, and I catered it. And they subsequently told me that we couldn't have lobster during, because the smells were wafting out and making people nauseous. But the chemo party became a celebration of friends and family. So every 2 or 3 weeks when she'd have the chemo, her friends would gather. And it became 3-4 hours of just joy. And word got out, and people would come from out of town and sometimes from other countries to attend a chemo party.
And it's tough to keep a positive attitude in a situation like that. And there must have been days when you were in great despair and sadness, obviously, when this was happening. So what are your thoughts on dealing with the emotions that difficult situations present, yet still trying to remain on that positive track?
So I think being positive, or a positive orientation, is a decision. Do I want to focus on the good or the bad? The feeling part, that's different. So I'll say typical male, but maybe it's not so typical anymore. I grew up in a dysfunctional family. I held a lot in. I had a lot of defenses. And I grew up before men were hugging each other all the time. It wasn't what I did. And my, as you mentioned, my wife was a psychologist, and she used to refer to feelings as the F word. And I was terrified of feelings, but she taught me to feel. And if you're going to open up those gates, you're going to feel the pain and the joy. And it's all a gateway to feelings. So in many respects, I had worked hard to be able to feel, and I was going to feel, and I just felt as much as possible, cried whenever I felt the need, and shared with friends.
You devote an entire chapter in the skills section of the book to love.
I knew you were going to bring
that. Yeah. What are the skills associated with love, and what do you think, the key?
The key to love. So the second half of the book is about 10 what I call universal skills that impact literally everything we do, from athletics to personal and professional aspects of our lives. And I knew that love was one of them, but how could I possibly write a chapter about love? I mean, love was something that all the great artists, the painters, the poets, movies, they're about love. What could I possibly do that wouldn't look pathetic? But you got to try. Mm-hmm. And it was so unbelievably enriching. And in the course of it took me a long time to write the book. And one of the reasons was I wanted to get it right. And I had a number of editors who were amazingly helpful. And I had a number of beta readers, men, women, young, old, different ethnicities, different countries. Because if I got one thing wrong, people would become suspicious of everything else in the book. So I learned a lot about love. It begins by literally saying yourself, I would like to experience more love. I want to open myself to love. And once you do that, there's so many practices that you can engage in. My favorite one, by far, it was described to me as a choice of coming from a place of love. And literally in every single interaction, before you hit the send button on the email, before you rebut the other person's stupid comment, before you say or do anything, you ask yourself, am I coming from a place of love? And assuming you want to come from a place of love, assuming you want to inhabit a more loving persona and world and community, you just modify it a little bit. And sometimes the words don't even change. It's the energy that changes. And when you're with somebody, sort of reverse this, if you're with someone who's acting kindly and compassionately and lovingly towards you, we respond in kind. To give a different example, when someone extends their hand to shake hands with you, we automatically respond in kind. When we act lovingly towards someone, when we just sort of have that energy, they respond in kind. And it's wonderful. But it's not just deeds, it's thoughts. As I go about my day and I watch my thoughts, I notice that I judge everything. Now, people say, no judgments. Well, of course, we couldn't cross the street without judging the traffic and the curb and how high we have to lift our leg and so on. And I find myself being unkind in my thoughts. And I catch it. And I go, okay, it's a long-held pattern. It's a knee-jerk reaction from society or whatever. And I go, let's modify that a little bit. I add a sprinkle of love to it.
I love that advice. Am I coming from love? I mean, just think about that. If everybody thought, because it's not only just thoughts and actions, words matter. And the words that we use do matter. And if you're doing it with love, you know, what a better world we would live in if everybody did that.
At the beginning of the book, there's two quotes. One is from Rumi. And a paraphrase, he says, when I was young, I thought I was clever, so I was going to change the world. Now I'm older and I'm wise, and I'm going to work to change myself. And practicing love and coming from a place of love, that's working on ourselves. And it yields enormous bounty. It's only good and there's no bad.
You cover a lot of territory in the book. Some of these questions and issues seem so big. Where do you recommend a person starts?
Well, you could start with whatever emergency is presenting itself. Personally, though, I'd say start by understanding that our reality is totally suspect. What we see, what seems so obvious to all of us, is different. Because I'm a guy. I grew up in the Northeast. I grew up in Boston. I went to an Ivy League school. I was brought up Jewish. I have my certain experiences. All this stuff colors how I see the world. And it's not just that. I mean, our five senses, we see things differently. I don't know if you've heard the Laurel and Yanni. If not, we can talk
yes.
about people.
Oh, yes. No, yes, absolutely.
People hear Laurel. Some people hear Yanni. 2 years ago, there was the internet sensation about the dress.
Right.
I personally saw a dark blue dress with black stripes. Other people saw a white dress with gold stripes. How is this even possible? So once we understand that we literally see the world through these filters of our biases and experiences and prejudices and desires and fears, once we realize that, we understand that the way we look at the world is just one way of looking at the world. So I used to, if I was having a conversation with you and you said something that was wrong.
You'd correct me.
I politely wait until you were done and then explain to you why you were wrong. And I was right. And now I don't put any energy into that. Now I love it when someone differs with me. If I'm having a political conversation and someone has some, shall we say, less enlightened view, I'm not going to tell them they're wrong. I'm saying, wow, this is so interesting. Why do you feel that way? And I learn so much when I do that. Another thing is in improv comedy, the first lesson in improv is something called yes and. So often when we're chatting with someone, they'll say something and we'll go, no, or no, but, or okay, but. That kills the dialogue. It slows it down. The other person feels like they're on the defensive, they're not being valued. But if in improv, it's yes and. Oh, I hear you. I acknowledge that. And I'm going to build on that. In addition, so if I disagree with anyone, my working assumption is it's 50-50. I'm probably 50% right there, probably 50%. What can I learn? Tell me more. What am I missing?
So what's next for you? You finished the book. You took a long time to write it.
So now I am having so much fun literally just sharing the lessons with people. And when I'm the book, it's not my wisdom, it's our wisdom. The people have been confronting these issues for literally millennium. You know, Plato and Socrates and Confucius. We're not the first people to wonder about this. And answers have been passed down, but we don't necessarily listen to it. So it was wonderful writing the book because I got to eventually condense millennium into 300 and some odd pages. And now the more I talk about it, I'm finding ways to succinctly communicate some ideas, and I'm having a lot of fun doing that. But the real answer to your question about what's next for me, it's literally when I walk out of here, it's actually a gorgeous day in Cape Cod. Will I remember to just look around and enjoy the day? The next person I interact with, will I remember to have a real conversation with it? Because so many times, it was the guy who came to fill the propane tanks yesterday. Well, it turns out he travels a lot. And we were talking about Tokyo and the Philippines. And the conversation went places I never would have suspected. So a shout out to you, Mike. And so my next thing is literally my next thing.
Joseph Deitch is the author of Elevate, and he'll be speaking about his book this Thursday, August 9th at Willow Bend Country Club. We'll have a link with more information about his book and the talk at our website, capeandislands.org. Thanks so much for coming in and sharing your thoughts with us.
Oh, so wonderful to be here. Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.